Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, July 10th, 2024. We have four cases set for our oral calendar. This is the final one of our four cases, A24-0223, Gary Burdoff et al. Versus Michael Miller. Counsel, will you be splitting time? Is this counsel here or?
I will be taking the entire time, Your Honor.
Okay, and is this your co-counsel?
Yes, this is Mr. Vance, my co-counsel.
Okay. Okay, I just want to double check on that. Thank you. And you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you so choose. This is being recorded, and it is also being live-streamed. However, no other recording is permitted of this proceeding. When you approach the podium, please say your name for the record and party you're representing. And you can modify the podium up and down as well as the microphone so we can make sure that we hear you as clearly as possible. And also for the recording, which will be available within a day or two. And without counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Marshall Tanick. With me is Michael Vancelo. Together, we represent the appellants in this proceeding, Gary Burdoff and Jeffrey Krueger. They are both in court this morning. Both of these gentlemen are affiliated with an organization known as Minnesota Association of Townships. That is a private, nonprofit, non-governmental organization.
And is that it's a
503,
correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yes, it is. Its function, its role, is to provide services to various townships in Minnesota. It provides legislative representation, lobbying, educational services. It also has a separate arm, separate organization that's known as the Mattit Insurance Organization that provides insurance, makes available insurance to various townships. But the organization itself is non-governmental. They have no it has no taxing power. It has no ability to pass any kind of legislation. It's a service organization for the townships. This case, as the court is aware, is a defamation case. Some very serious accusations were leveled against these two gentlemen, Mr. Krueger, who is the executive director, and Mr. Burdoff, who is the president of the board of the Township Association. One of the other members of the board, the respondent, Michael Miller, accused them of engaging in conduct that was like stealing or fraud, but he went on beyond that and orally and twice in writing stated that these two gentlemen attempted to steal, swindle, or defraud the insurance company, and furthermore accused Mr. Burdoff of committing the crime of sexual harassment, and also stated that these two gentlemen committed other, quote, unspecified crimes as well.
Mr. Tanick, before you get into the merits of that, the last preliminary comment you made describing Matt as non-governmental, that goes to the heart of, on the second issue, the judge...
The New York Times issue.
That it was not, they're not public officials, they were not acting, at least in this lawsuit, was not in that capacity.
Correct.
Separately, their township role, Matt is not a governmental entity, and so your point being is that that's off the table, or should be. That was an error of law in the district courts.
Right. That goes to the New York Times issue, which was one of the three... which was one of the two bases that the court below, the trial court, dismissed the case. We maintain that there were three fundamental flaws in the trial court's decision. One is the trial court dismissed the case on summary judgment on grounds that the statements made by Mr. Miller accusing these gentlemen of stealing, attempting to swindle, steal, and defraud the insurance company and engaging in the crime of sexual harassment, the lower court determined that those statements were subject to a qualified privilege, and then the court went on making fact findings that there was no malice made in connection with those statements. We believe that both of those determinations were fundamentally flawed. There is no applicable qualified privilege in this case, and even if there were, which there isn't, that leaves open a fact question of whether that privilege was overcome by common law malice, which the court made a determination on as a fact matter inappropriately. So we believe
generally that malice is an issue for a fact finder unless you still can grant summary judgment even if
sure.
It generally is. I want to focus on the qualified privilege
sure.
Issue if you could explain why you don't think that applies in this case.
Correct, and Your Honor's right. The actual malice issue, if there's absolutely no evidence of actual malice, it could be subject to summary judgment. We maintain there was evidence here that creates a fact as to actual malice, which I'll get to in a minute, Your Honor. But why the reason why we maintain that there is no qualified privilege is three or fourfold. The standards for qualified privilege are well established by case law, and there's not a dispute as to what those standards are. But we maintain that none of them, and certainly not all of them, were established here. One element of qualified privilege is that the statements were made on a proper occasion. There was no proper occasion here to make those statements. The accusations that Mr. Miller made had already been investigated thoroughly by Matt's treasurer, a gentleman named Mel Melender, whom Mr. Miller praised as being a, quote, straight shooter and a man of integrity. He had already investigated the concerns that Mr. Miller had brought up and had determined that there was no malicious conduct, there was no wrongdoing, no money changed hands in connection with this internal bookkeeping matter of how time was going to be recorded for the organization.
But Mr. Tanner, what would make it inappropriate for a board member to want a separate, independent investigation? And as the judge found, did he follow the policy of formally requesting that of the vice chair, as I recall, because it
Correct.
Was accusing the chair?
Well, he wasn't asking for an independent investigation. An investigation had already been done. So,
but from outside counsel, wasn't that sought to have independent outside counsel? Independent outside counsel.
I think that's what
the
board decided to do, because one of the accusations was made against Mr. Burdorf, who was on the board. But the matter had already been investigated, so we maintain there was no proper occasion. But secondly, even if there was a proper occasion, there's a question of the motive. There has to be a proper motive. In this case, Mr. Miller, the respondent who made these accusations, had a significant falling out and beef with these two gentlemen who are the appellants. He had been censured by the organization for other reasons, because he got into a tiff with the general counsel. He had been censured and reprimanded by the organization. He had also filed another complaint, unrelated to this, against Mr. Kruger, the executive director. He was very upset with how he felt the organization had treated him in connection with those other matters.
But your point of, you mentioned that those are unrelated matters. Aren't we supposed to be looking at what the issue is of whether or not funds had been properly used? And I just want to follow up on, I thought it was an insightful comment by Judge Slater, that what we're talking about here is a board responsibility. A board member has a fiduciary duty to the board, and in fact, there was a responsibility under, Resolution 204, I believe, something along those lines, which this is kind of a side issue, but I'm not sure why the board would want to vote to eliminate that resolution, which seems to go to the integrity of the board. But in any event, a board member has a fiduciary duty. Why doesn't this first element of qualified privilege apply in this case when you have a board member saying, hey, you know what, it appears that there may be an issue here. I need to report this to the board leadership to investigate whether or not anything has, in fact, any wrongdoing has, in fact, occurred.
Well, that goes to the context. As I said, it had already been investigated. But even setting that aside, Mr. Miller had an improper motive in raising these concerns. He's clothed it as a fiduciary duty, even though the matter had been investigated. But he had what he referred to as a rocky relationship with Mr. Kruger and Mr. Burdorf. He was very upset because the board, a couple months earlier, I understand that. We maintain that there was no proper motive or occasion to do this. But even if that's so, even if you take into account, well, he was asking for an investigation under this policy, there's another reason why the qualified privilege isn't applicable here, and that is a qualified privilege must arise out of some type of reasonable or probable cause. There was no probable or reasonable cause here. What happened here, without going into great depth, is that there was a couple of vacancies in the insurance arm of Matt because of COVID. So for a couple of weeks, Mr. Burdorf, the president of the board, and the general counsel, Mr. Fenske, not Mr. Kruger, the executive director, they stepped in and said, we'll take over some of the functions of the insurance company while we try to fill those vacancies. And for purposes of record keeping, their time was kept to see how much of their time was devoted to that matter. There was no payments, there was no money, there was no compensation paid to anybody. And that's what Mr. Melender, the treasurer, investigated. He determined that there was no wrongdoing, there was no malicious intent, no money changed hands. It was simply a bookkeeping matter that took about 2 weeks to sort out. Mr. Miller, however, had no reasonable probable cause, and Mr. Miller was at a meeting at which Mr. Melender, the treasurer, announced, gave his report. So he knew that there was no basis for any accusations of criminality by Mr. Kruger or Mr. Burdorf.
But you have, as you mentioned earlier, these are two separate entities.
Right.
MAT and MATIT.
Yep.
And one is a 501c3 entity. The other is a product of the legislature, the MATIT, the insurance company, correct?
Yes.
So even though there's an overlap between these boards, they still have to operate as separate and independent entities. Was there any agreement in terms of sharing of costs between these two entities?
No, there was no formal agreement, and they knew about it. They had this vacancy. This occurred during the holiday season during COVID. And because of these vacancies, it was agreed and talked about amongst the participants that we'll have Mr. Fenske, the counsel, and Mr. Burdorf, the president, do some work that has to be done here for the insurance company, and let's just keep track of their time so we can go back and see how much of their time was spent.
But that initial email from the employee of MAT indicated that there was going to be a reimbursement for both of them. Correct?
Well, she was wrong. She didn't know what the situation was. She
right,
was wrong,
but,
and Mr. Melender clarified that.
Well, whether or not she was right or wrong, that was part of the allegation. That was part of the information that Mr. Miller had early on, correct?
He had that at the beginning of the process. That's when Mr. Melender did the investigation. He reported to the board that this is a mountain out of a no-hill. Nothing happened here. Mr. Miller was at that meeting. He heard that, and it was after that, knowing that there had been this investigation, he said that there was, that's when Mr. Miller then came forward and said, these gentlemen attempted to swindle, steal, and defraud the insurance company.
Why?
There was no basis for him to say that, no reasonable basis.
Why wouldn't a board member exercising their fiduciary duty to the organization, in this case MAT, why wouldn't it be proper for them to say, I realize that we've had an internal investigation, but out of an abundance of caution, I would like to have an opinion from outside counsel to make sure that we are doing everything properly, legally, by the books. That's a very, very common activity that a board will do to protect itself and to protect its own board members, because each board member is a fiduciary and is liable jointly and severally as a board member.
That's not what happened here. Had he done that, Your Honor, there wouldn't have been any defamation. He didn't do that. He didn't say, well, I think we ought to have an outside investigation looking into this. He went further than that, and that's another reason the malice, qualified privilege doesn't exist here. Qualified privilege is lost if there's what's called exaggerated language. That's the Bowl versus Cole case and some other case law. In this case, the language that Mr. Miller used was far from the rather neutral, impartial, placid language that you just cited as an example, Your Honor. What he said, it is, quote, clear, that's his words, that Mr. Kruger and Mr. Burdorf attempted to steal, swindle, and defraud the insurance company. That is exaggerated language. That's far from the kind of language that you just cited as an example, Your Honor, of carrying out a fiduciary duty. Mr. Miller later, a couple months later, when he resigned from the board, in a huff, I might add, he was very angry, and he resigned from the board, Mr. Miller said to the board, and this is in the record, he said rhetorically, did you fellows, he was referring to Mr. Kruger and Mr. Burdorf, did you steal anything? And he said, you certainly did not steal anything. So he recanted the defamatory statements that he had made. Furthermore, in his deposition, he was asked, is there any basis for you to assert, or is there a basis to assert that there was stealing, swindling, or defraud going on? He said, no. He was asked in his deposition, would it be inappropriate for someone to make those remarks? He said, yes. He also was asked in his deposition at pages 189 and 190, this is in the record document 34, he was asked in his deposition, is there any truth to the assertion that there is any attempt to steal, swindle, or defraud? He said, no, not in my mind. So in other words, he had made these statements recklessly, knowing they were false, and that gets into the New York Times issue a bit, after he had already heard the investigation report from Mr. Melender, and made it and stated in language that is extremely broad, extremely exaggerated, and that he himself later disowned. In fact, the strongest witness of the defamation case is him.
But I think that's the key. But that's part of the key. Those statements were made after. They weren't made at the time of the before the report, for example. This was made when he was resigning from the board,
yeah,
correct?
They were made a couple months after, but they reflect what his state of mind was at the time. He acknowledged
at the time that he resigned, not at the time earlier.
Well, that nothing had happened in the meantime. Nothing had happened to change it. He acknowledged that he was not only wrong, but there was no truth to his statements that he made a couple of months earlier. That constitutes exaggerated language and defeats the qualified privilege, as well as the New York Times issue, which hopefully I'll have a chance to address in rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Matthew Morley. I'm with the Rakusky-Hansmeyer Law Firm, which as of July 1 is now known as RGP Law Limited. I represent respondent Michael Miller. Your Honors, I'll start this argument a lot like my colleague at the firm started the summary judgment argument, which is to say, boiled down, this case really is about just a dysfunctional board of directors. Unfortunately, in the early part of 2022, there was quite a bit of strife. There was disagreement amongst factions of the board. And in that time period, my client, Michael Miller, as a board of director member, witnessed himself at an April board meeting, harassing behavior by President Burdorf against Treasurer Millender as my client attended via Zoom. He also was approached, he didn't seek this out, but he was approached in January of that year by Don Zimmerman, an employee at the time of MAT, who said that there was possible mishandling or misuse of funds by the appellant. And these are public tax dollars, these monies that MAT operates with are collected as member dues from townships across the state. So,
but counsel, MAT is a 501c3 entity. It is a nonprofit entity. Mm-hmm. It is not a governmental agency.
Yeah, that's true. It's not directly a governmental agency, but it sure has influence in governmental affairs because
a lot of nonprofits do. A lot of profits lobby. A lot of nonprofits engage in activities with government entities. That doesn't make them a government entity in and of itself, though, does it?
So I take this line of questions to be going to the New York Times doctrine of whether the appellants are public officials. And I'd point to a couple things. First of all, I'd point to case law. And there's a lot of case law cited in the Minnesota Supreme Court's fairly recent opinion of McGuire. From 2019, they give examples of people who have been found to be public officials. We're not talking public figures, we're talking public officials. One of them, well, certainly there's never been a question that somebody in holding elected office is a public official. That's always found to be the case. But in the terms of somebody like Appellant Kruger, who's the executive director of this nonprofit organization.
And we're talking about MAT at this point, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, correct. Because Kruger is the executive director of MAT, a hired position. That's akin to a case referred to in McGuire called Rosenblatt. That's a Minnesota Supreme Court case that found that the manager of a public ski area was a public official because that person was specifically responsible for how those public funds were expended and whether they were expended appropriately. So if a manager of a public ski area, which I'm going to assume does no lobbying to the state legislature, can be found to be a public official, certainly somebody in Mr. Kruger's situation would be a public official, because not only does he manage the funds that are public tax dollars that fund MAT, but on top of that, MAT does a lot of lobbying at the legislature on behalf of township interests.
So what's the basis for your argument that these are public funds for that go to MAT?
Sure. The deposition testimony is that MAT is funded by member dues coming from the member townships across the state. And of course, member townships are collecting taxes to be funding their...
That seems very attenuated, though.
Okay.
I mean, because with all due respect, and also your argument that it is a government agency, just because the members, the board members, happen to be government employees in their full-time job, I'm not sure how that turns the board, the 501c3 entity, nonprofit entity, into a government entity.
So I'm going to clarify and take a step back that I don't think this issue is made or breaks on the question of whether MAT is a government entity. The question is whether the people in these roles are public officials. And so finding that MAT is not a government entity is fine, and it doesn't defeat the issue.
Yeah, I'm just addressing that because that seemed to be the basis as to how you got to the argument that they are public officials.
It's a single factor, and even without that factor, I think there can be a finding that these folks, and the case law is clear that you don't look at these specific people, you look at the role that they sit in. So we're not looking at Kruger and Burdorf, we're looking at the president of the board of directors of MAT and the executive director of MAT, and whether that position is a public official position. And I think both are yes. And I haven't had a chance to comment on why Burdorf would be a public official, but he can only hold that role, and the president of the board can only hold that role if they are an elected township official. So it's part of their duties as a township official to serve on the board of MAT. You can't be on that board without being first an elected official in your home township. So there's really no practical way to be able to divorce yourself from that role as a township official and sitting on the board of MAT, because they're basically one and the same.
Well, with all due respect, I'm not sure I'm buying your argument, because it seems to me just because that's a requirement to be in that position as president of that association,
yeah,
all of a sudden makes that a government entity and makes that person a public official. I'm a little concerned about, there are a ton of boards, there are a ton of nonprofit entities and a ton of 501c3s here in the state of Minnesota, and many of them have government employees that serve on them, and it seems to be, I hate to use the phrase, but a little bit of a slippery slope if all of a sudden, just because you have a government official on that board or even as president, that all of a sudden that person now has become a public official.
So I see your point, but most of those boards that you're referring to aren't required. They don't have a requirement that to be a board member, you must be an elected public official.
What about the Minnesota District Judges Association?
Well, sure, some do. I'm not saying that none do.
There's a fair number out there that do.
Minnesota School Boards Association, you have to be a school board member to sit on that. That functions much like MAT does in this instance. So there are examples, but I think they're fewer and far between. It's more the fact that, I'll take the school board example. A school board member can't sit on the school board's association board as a district representative without being a school board member and sitting in elected office. What I'm saying is, since you can't do one without the other, there's no way to say I'm going to sit on the MAT board or the Minnesota School Boards Association board as a private citizen, because you can't just wander in and apply as a private citizen to sit on that board. You have to be an elected public official. So,
Mr. Marley,
isn't it
equally true, though, also there must be a public dispute of some sort? This seems inherently internal dispute.
So
that doesn't that also play a part in perhaps an error of the district court in describing this situation?
So that's a factor of the separate question of whether somebody is a limited purpose public figure. That's separate from public official. Public official, It has to be your official conduct that's the subject of the defamation, but that's the only requirement. When you're talking about limited purpose public figure, yes, there has to be a public controversy that exists prior to the alleged defamation taking place. It doesn't have to be known by the entire public, but it's got to be a matter of public concern. So that's our alternative argument. If these folks are not found to be public officials, they should be found to be limited purpose public figures, because by the time Mr. Miller submitted his written complaints, properly pursuant to board policy, I might add, in late May and early June of 2022, there had already been disputes in the open board meetings about, for instance, the Mel Millender quote-unquote investigation into what had happened as part of the looking into what happened with the invoice requests and payment requests between MATIT and MAT. Go ahead.
Yeah, counsel, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but I read your brief to state that if we agree with you on the qualified immunity, we don't even need to get into those other issues. So I was wondering if you could explain why you think qualified immunity applies and why Mr. Miller did not engage in common law malice.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So qualified immunity is based on public policy. The rationale is that there are statements made in particular contexts or on certain occasions that should be encouraged despite the risk that statements might be defamatory. And here we have a proper occasion for alleged defamatory statements because Mr. Miller, as I said earlier, witnessed himself harassing behavior by one board member against another, and essentially against the black letter policy of MAT, which had an anti-harassment policy in place at the time. He was also the recipient of essentially a whistleblower complaint that public funds were being misused. So as Judge Reyes, you said earlier, he has a fiduciary duty to the board to determine what should be done or if something should be done in response to those complaints. And I might add, Appellant Burdorf, in his deposition testimony, admitted that, yeah, when Miller got that complaint, he was right under his fiduciary duty to look into the issue. So what I really would like to explain, though, is where things went from there, because there's been talk about the treasurer, Mel Millender, looking into these issues already, doing a quote-unquote investigation. Well, that wasn't an investigation pursuant to policy. Policy 204 sets forth a very strict guideline about how these policies and or investigations and potential punishment should be handled. And that's not what was done by Mel Millender. He informally and on his own looked into some things, but by the time everybody got to the April board meeting, where there was a strong dispute between especially Appellant Burdorf and Mel Millender about his efforts in looking into those things, it became apparent to a lot of the board members, including Mr. Miller, that perhaps Mel Millender hadn't been told the whole story or hadn't been given all the information that would be relevant to his inquiry. So because no formal investigation had been done under Policy 204, Mr. Miller then, in late May and early June, submitted his two formal written complaints to Jane Youngkrantz, who was then the first vice president of the board, and couldn't submit them to Burdorf since he was a subject of the investigation.
But on that issue, it seems like, and appellant counsel made this point, is it'd be one thing to just in a two sentence, I wish to have these payment requests or invoice or whatever they are investigated and just stop at that. But when you combine all the things he said in there, including an allegation, even though, in other words, he heard Mr. Millender's investigation or at least inquiry into it and concluded nothing had gone wrong. So far all he had is nothing had gone wrong. In other words, there's nothing in the record to support his allegation, even in the email to Ms. Youngkrantz, that there's any crime. So doesn't that all play into the context and including the history that was developed to at least suggest there's a genuine issue of material fact as to common law malice, which it seems a lesser burden than the New York Times actual malice?
Sure. Yeah, and I'm glad you clarified that the question of exaggerated language only really goes to the question of malice. It doesn't go to whether a qualified privilege exists in the first place. So If you're asking about the common law malice standard, I see your point. You're right. It is a lesser standard than the actual malice standard of the New York Times. So just based on how the law is written, we have a stronger argument that there's no evidence of actual malice under that standard. But I'm not ready to concede that there's that summary judgment shouldn't also be granted on the common law malice issue, because if you look at the content of those complaints, yes, they're long, drawn out. He used some somewhat unprofessional language, but it shows his true belief that there still is more investigation that's needed. Right? First of all, on the claim of sexual harassment, I mean, he witnessed what he thought was harassing behavior, and other board members have testified similar to him, that they thought it was Berdorf that made those harassing statements. So I don't think his belief can be questioned on that, and that would go to malice, common law malice. The other part about the financial mismanagement, it just shows, again, that it's been his belief, and I think it was his belief since January, that A, something may have been wrong and needs investigation. I mean, to kind of take a step aside, this is quite different from a lot of the case law, where when you're talking about defamation, it's, you know, somebody who's already been terminated, and then there's a statement made in the media or to an employee group at large. You know, this statement was only made to Jane Youngkrantz, so even though it was long and contained some unprofessional language, it was not, he didn't abuse any privilege by mass distributing this. It was just given to the person who's the quote-unquote investigator under their board policy. So I think it just shows that he truly had a belief that this needed to be looked into. This was a request for investigation. This wasn't a statement that I've investigated this and I've determined that this is the case. It was, here's what I think may have happened. Please investigate pursuant to written policy, which Youngkrantz did. And it's in the record that she did a very thorough investigation, or at least started to, did a lot of interviews, made a lot of written findings, and then was entirely cut off when the board rescinded the policy and voted to dismiss all the claims without any findings by the investigator or the board. And I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I do a lot of defamation cases on both sides, plaintiffs and defendants, and I can't recall a single case I've had where such strong language was used accusing people of felonious conduct, and then the person who made those statements later on three occasions recants and says, well, I really didn't mean that. You didn't really do what I said you did. This is a very strong case of defamation on the facts and the law here. The malice issue that overcomes any, we maintain there's no qualified privilege, but even if there is, and we kind of went through that in a briefing earlier, the exaggerated language here creates a fact issue as to whether there is actual malice. And the courts in the Bull versus Cole case have said so, the Supreme Court, and this court in the Harlow case adopted the Bull versus Cole rationale that, quote, exaggerated language can either defeat a privilege or at least give rise to a fact issue as to whether actual malice exists. The statements made by Mr. Miller here were not, and Judge Reyes kind of gave an example of a contrary kind of approach, and counsel here kind of picked up on that, but those his statements were not the kind of passive, tranquil, I think we ought to look into this under policy number 204. He said, and I'm reading here the portion, he also said this orally at the board meeting, too, and then he memorialized it in two written documents. These are Mr. Miller's words. Quote, it's clear that Mr. Berdorf and Mr. Krueger, these two gentlemen, attempted to swindle, steal, or defraud an insurance company. He didn't say, I think we should investigate this. There's an issue here. I'm carrying out a fiduciary duty. He said it was clear to him, clear, that they had committed felonies, even though Mr. Millander, who had looked into this matter, had told him and the board, there is nothing there. There was just a bookkeeping matter that's been taken care of. No money changed hands. In those circumstances, at a minimum, there's a fact issue as to whether actual malice, whether the exaggerated language here, and I can't think of any much kind of language that could be more heinous than that, accusing these gentlemen of felonious conduct, but there's a fact issue as to whether there's whether actual malice overcomes any claim privilege, which we maintain doesn't exist anyway. So that alone, I think, requires a reversal of the trial court's determination on the qualified privilege issue, independent or in addition to the other points that I've made earlier. Also, it's worth noting that not only did he accuse Mr. Krueger, who wasn't even involved in the bookkeeping issue, Mr. Krueger wasn't even involved in that, but he not only accused them of swindling, attempting to swindle, steal, and defraud, but he also accused Mr. Burdorf of a crime, as he phrased it, of sexual harassment, and he said these two gentlemen committed other crimes, which he didn't specify. So that communication, orally and in writing, by Mr. Miller was well beyond carrying out any kind of fiduciary duty or calling for an investigation. He told the board what he thought was clear in his view. But it wasn't clear, and later on he said, oops, I didn't really mean that. I used poor judgment. I don't always use the right language. He even said he blamed his teachers. He said, I should have learned better in school what words to use because I don't use good words. That's what he said later on. But the harm was felt by these two gentlemen who were accused of felonious conduct. As to the New York Times issue, we maintain as a threshold matter that neither of these gentlemen were public officials. This is not a government entity, and you can't be a public official if you're working for a non-government entity. That just ends the inquiry right there. Nor are they public figures. Public figures are people who are kind of well known to the public, in the public eye, entertainers, celebrities, other people like that. This isn't them. MAT is an organization that I doubt anyone, very few people have heard of, other than the township community, and these two gentlemen are well below radar. Nor are they limited purpose public figures. Limited purpose public figures are individuals who inject themselves into a public controversy. There is no injection here. The only injection was the injection by Mr. Miller of a felonious conduct by these two individuals. They didn't go out in public and make any statements or comments. They were the recipients of the injection. They didn't inject themselves anywhere, and there was no public controversy. As Judge Sleater pointed out, this was an internal bookkeeping matter that was looked into, taken care of, and it was of no public concern at all. So for all of those reasons, among others, the New York Times rule doesn't apply here at all. But even if it does, there's still an issue of actual malice, New York Times malice, knowing falsely or reckless disregard for the truth, as to whether the defendant, Mr. Miller, entertained serious doubts about what he was saying. That's a fact issue. And there's ample evidence in this record that we've cited in which Mr. Miller himself, he's the strongest witness for our side of the case, because Mr. Miller said, you fellows certainly did not steal anything, after he had already accused them of stealing. So we maintain that New York Times here is not in play, but even if it is, there's a fact issue as to whether there was actual malice that warrants reversal of this lower court determination on both the qualified privilege and the New York Times issues. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for the briefing and the arguments. Very well done on both sides. We appreciate that. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory time frame. That is our last case for the calendar for today, so the court is now in recess. Thank you both. Thank you all very much.
All rise. Gentlemen.